Welcome back, everybody, to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judy Weigel, your host and amicable divorce expert. Why? Because that's all I do, amicable divorces. Today, we have another episode on co-parenting and our children when there's a divorce. We are going to be speaking to Frances Berry, a licensed marriage and family therapist, and interestingly, one of the few people in Los Angeles that truly works with children. We're going to ask her why, but in the world of therapy, it was my surprise that too few therapists work with children. And when you find a good one who does, they are gold in your life. So a little background on Frances. She was born and raised in Ireland and came to the United States to go to graduate school. She graduated with a degree in clinical psychology from Antioch University, then trained at the Early Childhood Parenting Center, Airport Marina Counseling Center, and Family Services of Santa Monica. She received supplemental training that prepared her to work with children of all ages, including teaching mindfulness to children. As a quick aside, Frances, what is mindfulness?
Well, Jon Kabat-Zinn describes mindfulness as living in the present moment without judgment. But when it comes to children, Susan Kaiser-Greenland, who's an expert in teaching mindfulness to children, we define it as the new ABCs, which is children paying attention, having a balanced life, and having compassion for themselves and others.
Excellent. And we'll definitely get to this when we talk about the children and best interest of the children. Finally, and this is where I met Frances, she's a member of the California Association of Marriage and Family Therapists, Los Angeles chapter. She's also a member of the American Psychological Association and the Association of Child Development Specialists. Thank you for coming here, Frances. Welcome.
Thank you, Judy. I'm very happy to be here.
So, lots of questions. Let's get started. What does a healthy and positive co-parenting relationship look like and sound like?
Well, first of all, I want to say that parenting is really hard. So no matter how well-adjusted or self-reflective an adult is, parenting, it's a mix of all different kinds of personalities and belief systems, particularly when you're co-parenting. So I'll say up front that parenting is hard. I just do want to say that. But a healthy co-parenting relationship, to me, that exists when parents set boundaries, they discipline, and they create structure in the household that is similar. So they may not agree on everything with regards to parenting, but they don't argue about it in front of their children. They have a united front for when it comes to parenting. So, for example, parents should agree in this day and age of electronic media, there's a lot of arguments with kids and how much time they should spend on media and social media. Parents should come together and agree on how much time and what kind of media their children should be looking at. Something as simple as what time they go to bed or whether their child should have an allowance or not.
That's great and easier done, never easy, but
right.
Easier done when you're living in the same household. But
right.
Now, when we use co-parenting as a result of divorce and there are two households, how do the parents bridge the gap when parents will then maybe veer from the united front they had at the house and integrate their own bedtimes, computer times?
Well, in the ideal, and I'm saying ideal in inverted commas, of divorce, children would still follow the same rules in both households. Parents would still have a united front. And that requires, I will say, enormous discipline on behalf of both parents, that they are communicating together, that they are agreeing on the rules. So if your 8-year-old goes to bed at 9 o'clock in one house, they go to bed at 8 o'clock, at 9 o'clock in the other house. So it's, but you know, this is where parents have to put the interests of the child first. And sometimes when, I mean, if you take the example of, let's say, a family, two parents getting divorced because one parent is leaving to go be with somebody else, it takes an enormous effort on the other person's part to take the higher road, swallow that bitterness and anger and resentment, and, you know, not lash out at the other parent and, you know, not use the child. It's unfortunately very often the child gets used as a pawn in between both parents. When they want to lash out at one parent, the child gets caught in the middle. So when I'm asking of a parent, I recognize it's really hard.
So do you think parents are even aware of using their children as messengers and sounding boards and weapons in the ongoing unresolved issues from the divorce that led from the marriage that led to the divorce?
Not always, because sometimes it's really subtle. And we'll take, for example, you might one parent might be looking for child support, and the other person is late. So they write the other parent a note. They pop it in the kid's backpack, and this is not the kid's responsibility. This is the parent's responsibility to have this communication. One, you're giving the child responsibility that's not theirs. One, they might forget to give the other parent the note. But if they give the parent a note, the parent potentially will react in an angry manner. Now, they're not angry at the child.
But they will say it to the child, right?
Right, exactly. And very often, even if they don't say something to the child, if the child sees that the parent is angry, they themselves take it on. They take it on themselves, and you know they're like, "Well, I'm making mommy or daddy angry." When that's not the case, because children have a tendency, they want to love both parents. They don't want to blame the parents, and so they very often just take it on themselves.
So, can you give any other example of the unhealthy co-parenting and using the child in a manner that is not befitting the child?
Well, you actually brought it up as like using the child as a sounding board or using the child to find out information about the other parent, particularly if the parents are starting to see other people. It's, you know, what is mommy doing? You know, how much time did you spend with mommy's friend? How much time did you spend with daddy's friend? What are they like? What do they do? Are they nice to you? Trying to look for reasons why you can complain about the other partner. And then sometimes, and particularly for older children, more so, like if they're teenagers, sometimes one parent, if they're feeling very alone, they can rely very much on the older child as a sounding board for making decisions, like adult decisions. I mean, I had one case where I had a father and daughter in the room, and some subject came up, and the father turned to the daughter and said, "What do you think?" And she's 10 years old, and she turns to him and says, "Dad, you're the adult. It's your decision." And she was right. You know, it was his decision, you know, but they couldn't, they didn't want to make decisions by themselves. And so, you know, you got to be careful that you want to allow your child to be a child.
Do you think that parents will engage their children in the parental decision making without even knowing it sometimes? I'll say innocently, because it's still a way of getting out the hurt, the anger, the bitterness they may still feel towards the other parent?
I mean, it's possible. I mean, I think over time, in some cases, parents can be bitter for, honestly, I've seen it up to 5 or 10 years. But in some cases, people can get beyond the bitterness after a few years. But I think very often parents are so hurt, but they don't realize how hurt they are, that they very often need to do quite a bit of work on themselves. And, you know, if your 14 or 15 year old is there and they're complaining about daddy or mommy because the other parent wouldn't let them play video games, for example, it's very easy for the parent to sort of almost like relish that the child like loves them, and I put that in quotes, better than the other parent, because it makes them feel more validated and love themselves. So, I mean, divorce is very complicated, and it's just, you know, I think parents very often don't realize how much pain they're holding themselves. And when they don't realize how much pain they're holding themselves, it can come out in ways that are not very constructive. And if there's children caught in the middle, children can get caught up in that pain, even if you have the best of intentions.
Exactly. And I really do feel, at least with a lot of people who come here, they all have the best intentions. They just don't know what it looks like to not involve their children in the ongoing co-parenting relationship and just deal with the parent-child one-on-one. My heart goes out to every couple who has parents, every couple who has children. I know how hard it was for me to get divorced, and mine was so amicable, but it was still individually very, very painful to me. But it was over. Without children, we didn't have children. It was over once it was final. But for people who have to enter the co-parenting relationship, especially with really small children, so we're talking about a long time, I think this is the hardest aspect of divorce. And that's why I like to spend time in these podcasts dealing with this, because I think people need as much help as they can get.
I mean, something as simple as there was one case where the mother actually saw her son once every 4 to 6 weekends. It's a long story, but she purchased for her son a tablet because she wanted to FaceTime with him when she didn't see him. But the father had a very negative reaction to that because he felt the money could have been best spent elsewhere. And this is where, you know, major purchases like this, both parents, and so the father was incredibly angry and did, you know, and was angry at the son for accepting the tablet. And so both parents were in the wrong, but, you know, this is where, you know, both parents need to come together to make, you know, make major, when you make major purchases for the child, you know, what is the, where is the money best spent? Again, when it comes to electronic media, what you, who wants what, but, you know, you take it outside of the child's realm and you have that discussion if you're really, really mad. But again, you know, if you're really mad and you react automatically, it's just easy to yell and scream at the other parent, but it's the child that that's absorbing all of that.
So practicing resistance, practicing holding our tongues,
right?
Practicing that restraint is probably,
and knowing what your triggers are, you know, that, you know, when like if, or if knowing that another parent is what, that they do feel like that they're out to deliberately get at you, you know, is just do a little bit of swallowing and like, okay, this is the other parent. I can't change the other parent. The only thing I can do is I can change myself. And I can learn to be more tolerant. But you can't, I've had so many parents say to me, when is this going to end? Why won't the other person stop attacking me? Well, the other person is, let's say, is not in my therapy room. I can't work with that other person. You yourself have to learn how to change and to adapt and to make the environment as comfortable as possible for your children.
So that, you've kind of answered the question I was going to ask next, and that is, how do parents go from unhealthy to healthy co-parenting relationships?
Well, within, parents tend to, first of all, parents tend to parent the way they themselves were parented. There are many parents that will, you know, they find themselves yelling at their child and all of a sudden they'll stop and they'll be like, oh my God, what am I doing? This is exactly what my parent did and I swore I would never do this. So when it comes to, even when the parents are together, co-parenting is hard, and it's harder when they're divorced. But let's say even parents when they're together and raising a child in the same house, you have two adults who are raised by two totally different sets of parents, different belief systems, and now they're coming together, and their marriage may have been perfectly happy, and they did not even really realize that they had different belief systems about child rearing until a child appears. And all of a sudden, it's confusing for everybody because we were getting along perfectly well, and now this child, as an example, bites somebody, and we have two totally different reactions for how we're supposed to respond to that. So if two parents come to me and they're struggling with co-parenting, one of the things I do is help them, like have them both go back to their own childhood and help them. We don't have to process everything, but what I want them, each parent, to understand is how the other parent was raised. What environment was it? Loving? Was it nurturing? Was it demanding? Was independence fostered in one family? Independence fostered in another family? And then, so for example, if I gave the example of we have a small child that bites another child, and this did actually happen where one parent, their response was they actually wanted to bite the child in to show the child how badly it felt, which definitely I do not recommend. And the other parent wanted to give the child a time out, which also I don't really recommend. But, you know, the parents couldn't agree on, so they did nothing. And so the child remained undisciplined with regards to biting other children. So I think what I recommend is for new parents in particular, Dan Siegel's book, Parenting from the Inside Out, is a really great book for exploring how your own parenting has affected how you will currently parent and doing some work on yourself and really making decisions that you're making a decision with choice of how you want to do something. You're not just reacting based on how you've been triggered. And then if parents can't decide how to discipline a child, another one of Dan Siegel's really great books is No Drama Discipline, which really, I think, provides some great guidance on the best way to discipline children.
You brought up something so valuable and so important that I, as a non-therapist, a mediator, have used just to start the people thinking when we're in the mediation room and we're talking about the visitation schedule. And it's something a therapist friend of mine taught me. This is the genome tree, right?
Mm-hmm.
That you're talking about. You go back to look at how you were raised, not to blame anybody, never to do that, but just to see why your behavior today exists.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to reflect and say, do I like this behavior? Ah, I understand it now. And you certainly can grow an appreciation and not blame the other parent if you understand how the other parent was raised. Ah, okay. So do we like this behavior? Do we not like it? We can change anything we don't like.
Exactly.
But to understand it puts you in the position of not blaming. And when we can take blame out of the equation, we can co-parent better, right?
Yes, definitely. Because blame leads to resentment and bitterness, and you have less control over your emotions when you're bitter. And I think what you said is exactly right. You don't, like, you when a parent does something, then the other parent might react with, oh my goodness, I can't believe you did that. But if they have a reaction which is non-judgmental, which is like, I understand why you did that, I don't agree with it, but I can see where you're coming from, then you're at a starting point where you can actually have a conversation as opposed to pointing fingers at each other and, you know, saying things like, you always do this, or not helpful.
Right. Instead, I understand. Do you remember telling me about how you were raised and that your parents had this reaction with you? You can be very instrumental in creating awareness for the other parent.
Exactly.
Without judgment, without blame.
That's right.
Okay. Excellent. Excellent. All right. Now, this is something interesting. So there's a phrase everybody uses in family law called best interest of the child. But how does that play out in everyday parenting relationships? Can we provide some key examples of how best interest of the child would apply in everyday situations?
Well, you're right. There is a legal term, the best interest of the child, for California law. But in my case, as a therapist, I'm looking out for what is the best interest of the child, like their emotional health. And as an example, like there are sometimes children, they just want their parents to get along well enough that they can come to a sporting event, like at the school. And you'll be amazed at how many parents split up sporting and school events because they can't stand to be in the same room as each other. But for a child, like playing soccer, for example, you know, a little girl running around on the field playing soccer and she scores a goal, you know, more than anything else, she wants to celebrate it with both parents. And now, even if they have to sit on different sides of the field, at least both parents are there. And that's putting the best interests of the child first and not your, like, I can't stand to be in the same room as the other person.
And it's not on your parenting day, so you can't come.
Right, exactly. Yeah, not
good example.
Doing, that's a good example where parents say, yeah, well, it's not your day, so you shouldn't be there. But this, if the child really wants that, it means a lot to them. I mean, I had a child whose parents, honestly hated each other, actually. I couldn't even co-parent with them because they wouldn't sit in the same room together with me at the same time. But the child, he expressed to me that he really wanted, like, his parents to go out to lunch with his parents, with them together, and they would be civil to each other. And that's all he really wanted. And it doesn't seem like a lot to ask, but for some parents, it is a lot to ask. But this child was suffering from extreme panic attacks, and he was being bullied in school. His life was very unhappy, you know? But his parents, this is where you try and put, like, you have to put your own bitterness aside and put the interest of the child first.
So there's a situation like you just described. And do you, as a therapist, ask if you can bring the child, if they can bring the child in, so that if you can't get the parents to work together, you can maybe deal with the child so the child's reactions can be framed, so the child's understanding can be framed differently?
You mean, like, would I just see the child by themselves?
Yeah, can you ask, if a couple comes in for their own co-parenting issues, can you ask to see the child separately? Do you ask to see the child separately?
That's a good question, and it depends on the nature of my relationship and how it starts. Very often, if I am seeing the parents together, I might actually refer the child out to a separate therapist in terms of, and then I would work with that therapist if the parents are my client. But if I see the child first, very often the child is my client, and then I will do what is necessary. I will work with the parents however necessary to support that child.
Why would you have another therapist come on board just for the child?
It depends, but if I've had a long-term relationship with the parents, if the child is younger, that wouldn't be the case, let's say a 4 or 5 or 6-year-old. But if the child is a teenager and they feel at that point that the parents are my clients and I'm on the side of the parents and not on them, then it might be better for a teenager, for example, in particular, to have their own therapist. It's a case-by-case situation.
I get that. And would it also be for the child to be able to speak completely freely to the therapist without that therapist feeling beholden to report back to the parents?
Exactly. And
the therapist would report to you and you would talk to the
possibly
parents.
If the child, I've definitely had children, you know, where I see the child first and the child is my client, where they'll say something and then all of a sudden they'll stop and they say, you won't tell my parents I said that, right? And very often, or you won't tell my dad I said that, or my mom I said that. And very often, when a child has been dragged through the courts through a really ugly custody battle, they're so afraid of saying something that is going to end up in court, and then mommy or daddy is going to get mad at them. So, you know, I have to assure children that their confidences, are with me. Unless a child is going to hurt themselves or someone else, obviously, there are some exceptions. But in general, if the child is upset about something the father or the mother did, then they have an adult that they can freely talk to and process it. And younger children, obviously, that's more for older children. For younger children, I do a lot of play therapy. So
I like play therapy myself.
So do I, actually.
Yeah, I'd like to bring it on every day, as a matter of fact. Okay, now this is interesting, because we began this episode or this talk with parents getting together and setting down communal guidelines that can work in both households for logistical things, definitely, right?
Right.
But here's another interesting situation. So you go from being parents in one household to being divorced parents, and you do have to set down guidelines for homework, watching TV, the computer games, bedtime, and maybe even diet.
I've definitely seen parents where there's been arguing over, like, the food that one parent feeds a child.
So, but there's another aspect of co-parenting that I believe organically happens that is individualistic in nature, and that is parents and children will have their own separate, unique relationships at a point when there are two households.
Mm-hmm.
Can we speak to the value or the harm? And is there any harm in that? Or is that just normal? It's going to happen naturally. And where does it happen?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think that there's necessarily harm in that. I mean, sometimes parents stay together for the sake of the children and they have a terrible marriage and the children are impacted anyway. So sometimes a separation can actually be healthier for the children. And all the research shows that, you know, when it comes to divorced families, that the children who function the best are the ones where the parents get along the best. All of the research shows that. So, I mean, in the ideal world, no one would get divorced and all parents would work it out and all children would live together, but that's just not the way it is. But I think even with divorce, with children, they will develop their individual relationships with the parents in individual households. And it gets even more complicated when, you know, parents start to date or to even, you know, remarry, and then potentially step parents get involved and step children. There are also step children. So it makes it even more complicated. But I think it's still possible for divorced families to have a healthy individual relationships with their parents. But what's really important is that parents do not, whether it's implicitly or subtly, they don't criticize the other parent. They don't, particularly if a parent remarries, for example, not to undermine the other parent. There is always the fear that, you know, from one parent, when another parent gets married, that they're going to lose their child. But you have to, you know, overcome that and know that children want to love their parents equally. And that a step parent, no matter how good they are to them, is rarely, if ever, going to replace another parent. Now, of course, there are some exceptions where parents are not involved or there's alcohol or drug addiction, you know, involved in the family, then that gets things a lot more complicated. But if we talk about a normal family where there aren't those kind of problems in the family, then it's still possible for a child to have a healthy relationship with each parent, and that those relationships will be healthier the more the parents can have a united front.
Right, because, you know, one parent may like art museums, the other parent doesn't. So maybe when you were together in a household, there were fewer art museum trips, but now that there are two households and you have to do social activities with your children, you can each, as a parent, do the things that you love and want to share with your children.
You can share passions with your children. And the idea, best idea would be to focus on the strengths of each parent. And like you said, maybe one parent happens to be a little more nurturing than the other. So when the child is sick, they spend more time with that parent. But another parent is better at organizing, for example. So they help them with their back to school events, you know, where the parents can focus on their own strengths and pass that along to their children and involve their children that way. But again, what I'm saying, you know, I have seen it work in families, but I have seen it work, you know, in families where it just, parents can't get beyond that bitterness and blame of each other. And so for those kinds of families, what I'm asking, I recognize, is really, really hard. And it takes a lot of work and discipline on the part of the parents to be able to do that.
I know. And if they are able to, with therapy, with understanding their roots, if they could just do that, they would actually physically feel better. Emotionally feel better. People don't realize, I mean, I'm telling you, the therapist, saying this to you, the therapist, but, you know, to the audience, is people, we don't realize what anger and resentment does to us individually, physically, emotionally, mentally. And carrying resentments is, I think, maybe a form of control. We feel like we're controlling life. But letting go of that will just bring so much joy and resilience back to your life. Do you agree? Or
right. No, I mean, I think that very often, you know, when I see adult clients who, you know, struggle with anger management issues, they very often are not, you know, they're unhappy people. And a lot of this anger and resentment, if you can work through it and figure it out what it is that you're angry about, you know, there's a certain letting go involved and sort of a lightening of the burden. I mean, I have this phrase sometimes which is, you know, how heavy is your backpack? And, you know, what is it that you're carrying around with you all of the time? And how is that weighing you down? And how can you lighten that backpack?
This is a big question. What are the warning signs that your parental behavior may be negatively affecting your children, and what can parents change about their behavior to be a more child-friendly behavior?
Well, I think once, let's say, a divorce is in process, what's important to look for is changes in your child's behavior and or mood. And so particularly, let's say, some aggression, more aggressive behavior or attention-seeking behavior, or more sadness or anxiety, like not wanting to go to school, for example, because maybe afraid that either mommy or daddy won't be there when you get back, worrying about things like that. And excuse me. So then you have to take, I mean, divorce affects every child differently. Some children become more upbeat because they might see that a parent is upset. And so they want to prove to the parent that everything's okay. They don't want to worry them. In that case, even that, I would recommend therapy, because it gives the child an outlet, an adult to talk to, because, you know, that they don't have to worry about hurting a parent that's perhaps sitting at home. Kelly Clarkson has this song that where she talks about listening to her mother cry all night, you know, when her father left them. And so no matter how much you try to hide it, you know, for a child like that, that can be very, like, hard on them.
Should every parent, this kind of goes in tandem with this, should every parent put their child immediately in therapy at the onset of the divorce?
Not necessarily. Again, I think you need to look for changes in behavior and mood. And for some, and in some parents where the divorce is amicable, and also it depends on the age of the child. Some teenagers can handle it. They might be okay with the divorce if they see how unhappy their parents were together. And if both parents are still going to be involved in the divorce, I mean, after the divorce, and they're going to be involved in their parents' lives, and there's loving and caring, and there's an amicable divorce, not necessarily. But even if there is, I would just keep an eye out for, like, changes in behavior and mood, particularly attention-seeking behavior in younger children. That might be a sign that they need to do some processing of their anger and confusion about what is going on, and perhaps self-blame of, you know, if mommy and daddy were fighting, let's say, over parenting issues, then some children say, well, it's my fault mommy and daddy are getting divorced because, you know, I didn't put my shoes away or something like that.
It is,
you know?
Interesting. Kids do think
and
like that.
Kids do think like that.
Yeah,
they do.
I am told by my other therapist friends. One thing about my sister's divorce, it was a million years ago, very, very contentious, had to be litigated. But the one thing they both did, she and her ex-spouse, the one thing they both did that was the best thing they could have ever done for their three children, ages 3, 5, and 7 at the time, was they lived 5 minutes apart, and they let the children decide whenever they wanted to be at each parent's house. They didn't have to be together. It could have been just 1, 2, or all 3, and neither parent grumbled about driving them back and forth.
That's perfect. I mean, that's, you know, in the circumstances that they were able to actually, you know, put the children first and give them the ability to go back and forth. And particularly with something like a child as young as 3, they have a need for certain parents at different times. And it's important to be able to let them see mommy or daddy whenever they do want to see them.
Yep. And the 3-year-old, who I'm close to all 3 of them, but I was speaking to the then 3-year-old recently, and I asked, well, what do you remember about that time? And he said, everything. It was so horrible. Mommy and daddy were fighting so, my parents were fighting so much that when there were 2 households, it was finally calm.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed it to be calm. So this goes into my very last question, and that is, how should parents tell their children about the decision to divorce? Should they even use the word divorce? Or are there any other words that could be used in place of divorce?
Well, I think if parents are getting divorced, it's okay to use the word divorce because that says a lot to a child. But what needs to happen is how it's explained to a child, because they may have friends, for example, who are divorced, who, you know, their child's best friend never sees daddy anymore, for example. What you have to explain to the child is what divorce means for your family. And let's say you have one child and you sit down with a child, both parents, and you talk about that you're going to live in separate homes, but that you love them very much. It has nothing to do with them. It is not their fault. And assuming both parents want to be involved in the child's life, then that they're going to see both children, that they're going to see both parents, and that they won't be abandoned. But, you know, again, if there's a lot of bitterness between the parents, having that conversation with the child can be really hard for one or both parents, where they really have to swallow like any blame that they have for the other parent for the separation and not lash out. It has to be a neutral conversation, and that the child has to be assured. And very often the child has to be assured over and over and over again that this is not their fault and that they are loved by both parents, just that mommy and daddy can't live together as adults, and so they have to separate.
And you don't go into it any more than that, right? You don't share the reasons with your children.
Not necessarily. I mean, again, it depends on the, like a teenager who is 16 or 17 may push much harder, you know, for reasons, but
why? I just need to understand, right?
Yeah, something exactly. Like that. And if that's going to be the case, then the parents need to have agreed ahead of time how much information they're going to share with a child, and not one parent suddenly, you know, like lose their temper and be like, well, you know, the other partner had an affair. You know, that's not what you want to happen. I mean, it does happen, but ahead of time, you know, the parents need to agree how much information they're going to provide and how they're going to provide that information to the children. So it can be, and if necessary, the parents should find a mediator or a therapist or somebody where they sit down and say, here's what we're going to tell the children. And we've both agreed that we can say this much together, and we can be neutral about it. How does it sound?
Okay. And what are your thoughts on this? So you're planning on having the family talk, and you already know, should it be when you already know when the second household will be established with the visitation schedule already considered? Should all of this be done so that when you talk to your children, you can give them concrete steps going forward?
In the ideally, that would be the case, but I think sometimes you're not, like, the one parent is already planning to move out before you've made all of those final decisions. And so in the ideal world, you would give them as much concrete information as possible, particularly if they're younger, like especially under the age of 10. If they're older, like 12, 13, 14, 15, then they may actually want to be involved in the decision-making themselves. And sometimes the courts do allow that. So it depends, I think, on the it depends on the age of the children. And then also, if mommy and daddy are fighting so much that it's really better that they're in separate homes, but they haven't figured out the visitation rights yet, then it's just not going to be possible.
Okay, so if there has to be two households just to calm everything down, and that's all they can do right now is get two households together, then should it be said that this is the best we can do right now? You know, you'll see both of us. We will just work it out and see what works. And then when mommy and daddy have an opportunity to sit down and look at how we can best have both, you know, we can be in each other's lives as a family. I'm even struggling for words too. You know, because you have to look at what the parents' schedules are, what the children's schedules are for school, who can support those schedules. There's a lot of logistics
to work out. There's a lot of logistics. I mean, if both parents work, for example, or if just one parent works, you know, picking the kids up. I mean, even for parents who are together, I mean, people maintain spreadsheets to, like, you know, record how we were going to pick up so-and-so at 5 o'clock from, like, from their soccer practice, and we're going to drop the other child off for taekwondo. You know, I mean, there's a lot of coordination, and You know, if especially if both parents are working, then how do you manage that schedule? So there's a lot of logistics, and children, you know, it can, I mean, the ideal situation is where the children, you know, what's known, I believe, as nesting, whereas the, you know, the children stay in one home and the parents go back and forth. But that's, you know, incredibly expensive, and, you know,
it's
parents,
tough.
And it's really hard to do.
I've had people come in here and say, we tried nesting, but we each want our own space.
Right, exactly. But it's a lot of logistics for the kids to be worrying about bringing clothing back and forth, bringing homework back and forth. You know, do if I am doing working on a school project, you know, can I run back to mommy's house and pick up what I need to do? There's a lot of logistics to work out, and children will worry about all of these things. So it's up to the parents to try, and it's not going to be easy, but how can you make it as easy as possible?
And
for
it
the
evolves.
Children?
So yes. We're going to try our best at first, and everybody will say what's working, what's not. And we'll eventually come to a schedule that works for everybody.
Right, exactly. And for important events like, you know, like say, like school meetings, for example, if your child has an IEP, for example, you know, there are meetings that it's good for both parents to be able to attend with the school counselors and whatever other services the child is receiving. And it's important that both parents can come together for meetings like that and be able to coordinate.
Best of luck to everybody with children. So, Frances, we could go on and on. We'll have to save visitation schedules for another time, mm-hmm. if you would agree to come back.
Of course.
Back. So thank you so much. Now, if people want to get in touch with you, slowly, and we're going to repeat it, how do they get in touch with you?
Well, you can contact me by phone at 310-487-6061.
Again,
that's 310-487-6061. And then my website is francesbarry.net. And that's Frances spelled with F-R-A-N-C-E-S. My last name is Barry, B-A-R-R-Y. So it's francesbarry.net.
Thank you, Frances. This has been really good for me, too. I can use this information in mediations. Thank you for coming here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So if you would like to get in touch with me, anybody listening, give me some ideas for topics for podcasts, I can be reached at Judy, J-U-D-Y, at constructiveuncoupling.com. Judy, J-U-D-Y, at constructiveuncoupling.com. And as always, thank you for joining us, and we look forward to our next episode.